Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Absurdity of War. Pope Benedict recalled this week's 70th anniversary of the outbreak of the Second World War and prayed for the gifts of forgiveness, peace and reconciliation. Green Pope. We examine the link between environment issues and the Catholic Church and explore why caring for creation is a spiritual and moral concern. And organs on order. In the light of the news that China is trying to crack down on the use of body organs harvested from executed prisoners, we look at the wider ethical issues surrounding the issue of organ donations and transplants. At his general audience, Pope Benedict has spoken of the absurdity and tragedy of war in remarks recalling this week's 70th anniversary of the outbreak of the Second World War. Chris Altieri tells us more.
The most destructive conflict in human history began on the 1st of September 1939 with the German naval bombardment of the port city of Gdansk in northern Poland. Speaking in Polish during the audience on Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI said the absurdity of war, as well as the human tragedies that attend it, remain in people's collective memory. The Pope went on to say, "We ask God that the spirit of forgiveness, peace, and reconciliation pervade the hearts of men."
Europie światu potrzebna jest cisza, wspólnota ducha.
Europe and the whole world in this day need a spirit of communion, said Pope Benedict. May we build it on Christ and his gospel, on the basis of charity and truth.
Budujmy ją na Chrystusie I Jego Ewangelii, na fundamencie miłości I prawdy.
As an example of Christ-centered reform and renewal, Pope Benedict held up the 9th century abbot, St. Odo of Cluny.
Attracted by the Benedictine ideal, Odo became a monk and later the second abbot of Cluny. At the beginning of the 9th century, Cluny was the center of an influential movement of church reform, and Odo, by his example and teaching, did much to further the spiritual renewal throughout Europe. His writings reveal how deeply he was influenced by the monastic virtues of contemplation, detachment from this world, and longing for the world to come.
The Holy Father recalled how Odo was particularly devoted to the Eucharist, emphasizing the real and substantial presence of Christ under the species of bread and wine.
This conviction of faith led him to work for the reform of the clergy and to stress the need for a worthy reception of the sacrament. An authentic spiritual guide for his troubled times, Odo blended the personal austerity of a great reformer with a constant and joyful contemplation of Christ's infinite mercy. I offer a warm welcome to the English-speaking visitors present to this audience, including those from England, Scotland, Ireland, Nigeria, and the United States. Upon all of you, invoke God's blessings of joy and peace.
The Holy Father received the faithful at the Vatican inside the Paul VI Audience Hall, and then helicoptered back to the papal retreat at Castel Gandolfo, where he is spending the remainder of the summer. I'm Chris Altieri.
For the second time in a week, Pope Benedict has appealed to world leaders to address urgent global environmental issues, making it no surprise that he has been dubbed the Green Pope by many observers. The Pope says care for creation is a sign of respect for God the Creator and insists it is an essential part of our faith. He is also frequently warned that the poor and vulnerable, who are least responsible for contributing to our planet's climate change, will likely suffer its worst consequences. Pope Benedict's latest pronouncements on the environment preceded a conference on climate change that is taking place in Geneva throughout this week. In the run-up to a key UN conference on this issue, scheduled for December in Copenhagen. Mary Colwell is an award-winning Catholic environmentalist TV and radio producer in England and a consultant on religion and the environment for Bishop Declan Lang of Clifton, who is in charge of environmental justice for the Bishops' Conference in England and Wales. Colwell says that Pope Benedict's embrace of environmentalism is an inspiration for all Catholics.
I think Pope Benedict has done some amazing things. I mean, really fantastic things. I think he's done it almost sort of just got on with it. He's not made a big song and dance about it. He's not made great sort of showy statements. What he's done, he's just done it. He's put the solar panels in the Vatican. He's bought the forest as a carbon offset. But he's also made some very meaningful statements, building on the very, if you like, intellectual approach of John Paul II. Benedict seems to have got the idea that it really is important. It's not just words, it's action that counts. So I think he's made great start with that, and I hope that continues. And it's been very inspirational, I think, for everybody else around the world. So I agree, I think Pope Benedict has done some great things.
You have written that the environment is a spiritual and moral issue and not just a consideration for greenies, as you put it. Can you explain more and elaborate further on that for our listeners?
I think that our treatment of the natural world is very definitely a spiritual issue. It is fundamentally and quintessentially a spiritual issue. I think it's not difficult to understand that we have all around us as an expression, if you like, of God and of God's will, of God's character, of God's imagination, of God's diversity. And I think of people of faith, it's just all around you. It's staring in the face. And in fact, it's so much there, that's why it's so easy to forget. We forget that these other forms of life are all there because they have been in some way created. And I don't mean created as in creationism. I mean their manner of existing has been through God. And I think that fundamentally then is a spiritual relationship we have with things around us. I think that the natural world has inspired people of great faith throughout time, and all the great monastic traditions, be that Christian or Taoist, or whatever, all their founders of the monastic traditions had their experience by going out into the wilderness and having a direct experience of the natural world, being in touch, if you like, with something which is much greater and bigger and beyond the pure individual. It's that sense of being part of something which is absolutely immense, utterly mysterious, and yet we are intricately part of it. And it's those big, grand spiritual feelings which really inspire people to take on this green issue. And of course, it's a secular and an important secular political social issue as well. But the religious dimension gives a whole sense of awe and wonder and mystery and majesty to it too.
Now, talking of that religious dimension, I know that you work as an environment advisor to your local Catholic bishop, Declan Lang of Clifton. What kind of advice have you given or what kind of projects have you been involved in this capacity?
I think one of the biggest things that Bishop Declan and I have talked about is that apart from this regenerating and renewing this idea of our relationship with the natural world as being a spiritual issue, and we've talked about that a lot and how that can be expressed, but we've also talked a lot about how the environment simply isn't just climate change. I think something that I feel quite strongly about is that the environmental agenda has been overtaken. Hijacking is far too strong a word and has the wrong connotation, but has been, if you like, taken over by the climate change agenda. It's become a massive, massive political issue, and rightly so, but it isn't the only kid on the block. Climate change is one of many serious environmental concerns which we really have to start thinking about. The loss of species, the degradation of the oceans, the amount of pollution in water and air, the habitat destruction, the overfishing, so on and so forth. All these are massive issues which we have to give as much priority as we do to climate change. So my work with Declan Lang is to stress the wholeness of our approach to creation, so that it's not just a climate change issue, that climate change is part of that, but that every aspect of our life involves some aspect of our relationship with the natural world, and we have to have that whole mindful approach.
Do you, in fact, think that the fact that Pope Benedict, as I said earlier, has come out on a number of occasions and talking about the environment and, you know, making these concrete gestures inside the Vatican, like the solar panels, is having a trickle-down effect also on, you know, the grassroots level of Catholics?
I think there is a trickle-down effect. I think it could trickle a lot faster than it is doing. I still think that there's a lot of problem with people perceiving being concerned about the environment as somehow being tinged with some kind of paganism, or politically, oh, it's too far into the political arena and we shouldn't stray that far. This is a problem just to be solved by politicians. I still think there's that about it. And I still get people asking me, what's this got to do with faith? This isn't a faith issue. This is a political social issue. I think all those things are still there. There's still a lot of skepticism out there. I think wishful thinking, I think, about climate change isn't happening. But slowly, slowly, people are beginning to turn round on every level, not just the people of faith, but at every level beginning to turn round.
What have we done to the world? Look what we've done.
Okay, going global here, when we talk about environmental threats to our planet, one of the first images or thoughts that comes to many people's minds is the ongoing destruction of large swathes of the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. I know you visited the Amazon region earlier this year. What impressions did you gain there about the level of deforestation there, the whole environment question?
I think the Amazon basin is the burning issue, and if you excuse the pun on that, it is, for the Catholic world, it is such an important issue. If you think about it, the Amazon basin sits entirely within Catholic countries. So the Catholic Church, in my view, has a particular duty of care towards the Amazon. It sits in countries where Catholicism has a real influence on the people on the ground, local government, national government, in institutions, in schools, in universities. It's really omnipresent throughout South American countries, all the countries within which the Amazon basin sits. So for me, the Amazon could be a real focus of Catholic attention and awareness and action. And as a global faith, the global Catholic community has the opportunity to do so much to support any Catholic initiatives on the ground in the Amazon basin. Very much talking about this with the Jesuits at the moment. And the idea that if say, for example, a Jesuit community set up some kind of environmental awareness in, say, Brazil, that people around the world could support that. They could not only donate money, but also campaign. They could do awareness raising. They could advocate on behalf of that community as well. And in a sense, the Amazon then becomes something which the Catholic world can focus on, hold up as an example of where action can really, really make a big difference.
Now, you say could there. Do you feel, and do other people feel there, that the Catholic Church could be doing more? I mean, there are some very striking examples by individuals like Dorothy Stang, an environmental activist who, in fact, paid for her life due to her outspoken campaign, shall we say, against the destruction of the rainforest. And there's also been bishops that have, I know, have received death threats in the Amazon Basin region. But do you feel that these are just sort of only too few an example and it needs to be more across the board?
I absolutely think that. I think these are heroic individuals and real shining examples of fighting against all odds. But I don't get the impression there's a concerted, authoritative backup behind what's happening. I don't get the impression that people around the world in parishes in the UK are aware of what's happening in the Amazon. And I don't get the impression that the Catholic Church as a whole in South America is working together in unison to help the Amazon. And of course, these individuals, communities and so on are doing amazing things. And we owe it to them, and we owe it to the memory of people like Dorothy Stang to help them, if you like, coordinate and coalesce a lot more and know that they're not there on their own, that there's a whole global church behind them.
And turning to Copenhagen, how optimistic are you that the world there will take coordinated global action to reduce the effects of climate change and reduce greenhouse gas emissions? Do you think there is enough political will to take the necessary steps to grasp the nettle?
No. I think politics is going to have to be a different beast if it's going to take on board exactly what we're going to have to do to turn this around. And at the moment, a politics which is totally devoted to constant economic growth for growth's sake cannot, in my opinion, take the steps that's necessary to become leaders in the climate change agenda. I don't see how the two can sit side by side. Anything that threatens the economic stability and growth of a country is going to have to come second place to that growth. I think if it challenges the growth of a country, how can a country support it with the present system? It seems a very negative approach, doesn't it? But I think if it's left to politics alone, we will never, ever find a solution to this. Governments are there to protect the economy of their countries. And if that economy is threatened because people buy less, live more simply, don't travel so much, the economic downturn of those countries will be very difficult for that government to sell. And I just simply can't see how that's going to happen at Copenhagen. Everyone will be grabbing as much as they can for each other. And my feeling is that Copenhagen will get a lot of discussion going, it'll get a lot of awareness raising going, it'll allow people to campaign very strongly. Whether the big right decisions will be made, probably not, but I'm very glad it's happening because at least it's happening, if you see what I mean. I don't think Copenhagen will happen and everyone say, well, thank goodness for that, it's all sorted. I just don't see that happening. But I do think it will raise awareness and I do think it'll get people discussing the issues. And if we can combine the awareness raising with a spiritual approach to the natural world, then I think that perhaps we're onto something.
I was speaking to Mary Colwell, a leading Catholic environmentalist in Britain. China has launched a national organ donation system to try to reduce its dependence on body parts harvested from executed prisoners, who currently make up the majority of donors. Organ transplantation in China has long been criticised as profit-driven and unethical, with critics arguing death row inmates may feel pressured to become donors. Although a 2007 law bans organ trafficking, there are many reports of illegal transplants from living donors and of foreigners travelling to China for the transplants. In many countries throughout the world, there is a desperate shortage of organs for transplantation, which has helped to fuel a global illegal trade in body parts, whereby the rich travel to poor countries for such transplants. And how often have we read about reports in the media of a desperately poor individual who tries to sell one of his or her kidneys to the highest bidder to earn some money? But is it right that the poor should be exploited in this way and compromise their own health by selling a kidney to the rich? And when it comes to China, what exactly is the current situation like regarding the whole issue of organ transplants and the ethical questions posed by the use of executed prisoners as donors of body parts? Well, to find out more, my colleague Irene Lagan spoke first of all to Dr. Frank Delmonico, professor at Harvard Medical School and an expert on organ trafficking for the World Health Organization, who has visited China several times.
I've been to China on a number of occasions. And the vice minister is one courageous individual who is very well aware of the situation there. In fact, the number of executed organ transplants that are being done for foreign patients is much reduced from what it was in 2006-2007. At that time, about 11,000 transplants were performed in China from those who had been executed, about 8,000 kidney transplants and about 3,000 liver. Since then, Istanbul Declaration and the WHO Guiding Principles have had much impact on practices in China by way of regulations that have been developed 1 year ago, in which those regulations stipulated that foreign patients may not come to China to buy organs. Is it still going on? Yes. Do I know where it's going on? Yes. Do we receive documents about patients that have undergone transplants in China? Yes. but it is not to the degree that I just elaborated in number. It is much reduced. And I was just with Chinese officials in Sweden, and those numbers are showing perhaps something in the order of 2,000 transplants, where had been done 11,000 transplants. And yes, it is still with foreign patients, but it is much reduced. Now, what can you do to increase transplants around the world? Well, we have to obtain every opportunity of deceased donation. We have to increase deceased donation to provide those kinds of extra kidney, extra renal organs everywhere in the world, too. We also have to provide kidneys from live donors in a safe way, with informed consent, and without abuse. And it has to be done within one's country, so that the Middle East, the Gulf countries, cannot have the perception they can simply send their patients to South America or to Manila to buy organs from the poor people. That's what we're combating. So we have to turn around to each country and say, how can we maximize opportunities of organ donation and proper ethical practices of live donation in your country?
So it's fair to say then, because I think there's a lot of fears, and you've already answered this, that organ donation is something that is ethical, and that it's not something that people should fear upon their death, and that in fact it really is, as if I understand you correctly, a social responsibility.
You've captured something that I think is the most important comment of all so far. We have a social responsibility to provide for our fellow man at the time of our death, because our organs are going to decompose. There are cultural objections to organ donation, and they're understandable. But at the end of the day, education brings the following fundamental fact. When we die, we decompose bodily. And organs that reside in our body no longer become useful to us, but they can be useful for our fellow man. And that social responsibility has to be in the mindset of every country and every culture. For those cultures that make some objection about organ donation, what is a note of irony, and yet I would say revealing, is that they don't object to being the recipient of an organ transplant. So in Japan, where there's a hesitation about deceased donation, there's plenty of organ transplantation that goes on. Patients leave Japan and go to other places of the world to undergo transplantation because there's an insufficient number of deceased donors in a country of 120 million population. So there are cultural issues, there are fears, and there is apprehension, but education needs to resolve that. One other point I wish to make that was made very strongly at the Vatican conference in November, last November. Somebody better be dead when they become an organ donor. It ought not to be that someone's death is occasioned by organs being recovered or taken from them. That is also a very important aspect of Istanbul and the WHO guiding principles. There should be a proper termination of death before organs are recovered. That's the dead donor rule.
Just wanted to ask you quickly if there's anything else that you feel is important to add that I haven't asked.
Unless we make for a national self-sufficiency, you talk about social responsibility, governments of countries are now going to have to address, where are we going to get organs for our patient population? They can't dismiss this by saying, you can run off to Asia or South America and we can have you obtain organs from the poor people of that country. The countries themselves are somewhat fed up with that kind of an approach. In the Philippines, the president there made a very strong stance in saying, no longer can foreign patients come to Manila to purchase organs. So too should that be the responsibility of all countries around the world. They have now the obligation, if there's no deceased donation, they've got to get underway with it. And if there's live donation, there must be the oversight of society that says the poor person is not being exploited for their organs in that country. This is a movement now that has to capture the world's attention. And thank goodness, you know, great. We have to be very appreciative and supportive where Minister Jiafu Wang has taken this important stance in China. We must get a program of deceased donation underway. We can't be relying on people that have been executed, inmates in prisons, to be the source of organs for us or for foreign patients that have been coming to this country for organs. The reality of it is that the need for organs fuels the need for execution. And we know this without any hesitation of my saying to you in a public way. That demand for organs fuels the need for someone to be executed next Tuesday that's a B blood type or an O blood type or of some specification that would provide an organ for an individual who's coming to that country for the purpose of transplantation.
But what about the Catholic Church and its position on the issue of organ donor and transplantation? At a Rome conference on the issue last November that was sponsored in part by the Pontifical Academy for Life, Pope Benedict said organ donation must remain a gift of the donor, and organs cannot be taken from vulnerable people without their consent. The Pope said the main criteria must be respect for the life of the donor, so that the removal of organs is allowed only in the presence of his actual death. Dr. John Haas is the president of the National Catholic Bioethics Center in the US, and he told us more about the Church's position on this issue and the potential ethical problems surrounding the practice of organ transplantation.
Well, as you know, Pope John Paul II himself encouraged the donation of organs in his encyclical Evangelium Vitae and said that it was one of the ways in which love for neighbor can be expressed and manifested. So the Church has long accepted the legitimacy of organ donation from corpses, from people who are already dead. There's developed an acceptance of certain organs being donated from people who are still living, inter vivos, as it's called, if it's an organ that would not significantly impair the health of the donor. So the Church has accepted as legitimate both organ donation from corpses and also from the living, as long as certain conditions are met. The principal ones, obviously, from a corpse is that you have to be certain that the person is dead. That's generally known in transplant circles as the dead donor rule. It is strictly enforced in the United States. The Pope John Paul himself said that the dead donor rule has to be observed before organs can be extracted. Of course, then we move to the question of how do we determine death to make sure that we can remove the organs. So that's an area of some concern and conversation in our own day. But the principle of organ donation has been accepted for quite some time.
Do you find that, at least at the Bioethics Center, you have people who are concerned about letting themselves be organ donors, you know, on their licenses and other things that we have in place? And do you also find, or do you see that, is there an increase in demand for organs in the United States?
Oh, there's a great need for organs in the United States. We don't begin to meet the need, and so there are increasing efforts to try to find ways in which to obtain more organs, such as, for example, some people have advocated that there ought to be some kind of remuneration or incentive to people to donate organs. We're firmly against that. The Church is against that. But there's a great need for organs, but there also is a great need to make sure that we never kill anybody in the process of extracting organs for donations.
That was John Haas of the U.S. National Catholic Bioethics Center. And you earlier heard the voice of Dr. Frank Delmonico, an expert on organ trafficking for the World Health Organization. Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English program for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.